This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. Before we start the show this week, I have to remind you that we still have our survey going on for the next couple of weeks. You can win a $10 Comixology gift card if you go to ircbpodcast.com/survey. Fill out the survey. Let us know what you think of the show. If you have any other comments, please feel free to email us at ircb@destroythesybe.org. And now on to the show. With me this week are two people who are absolutely, completely not robots. Paul Jaisley.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Syntax error.
Thank you both for beep boop joining me this week. None of us are robots, we assure you. Let me ask you the question I ask every week. How are you doing? How are comic books? Let's start with Nick.
Things are good. I've been busy. Yesterday, I got a call from a neighbor who was like, oh shit, it's my anniversary and I need someone to watch the kids. So, of course, I went over and did what most babysitting is for me, which is eating pizza, step one, playing video games, step two. So we played Mario Party. And it was great, except I was losing. And I will be honest with the listeners. I was trying to win. You know, I don't hold back. I was trying to beat these kids. And because, like, you know, when we play, like, Old Maid or things like that, all of a sudden, all these house rules start appearing out of nowhere and I lose. So I was trying to win this, only to find out 2 hours later that they gave me one of the Wiimotes without Wii Motion Plus. So then I found out why Nick was losing all of the motion games. So the kids handicapped me right before we started the whole thing. And it was a great experience. So
you're not upset about that at all. It doesn't sound like it.
No, I'm not upset to the point where I would share it with lots of listeners. But I mean, it's a valuable life lesson. If you find yourself babysitting and they want to play Mario Party, check your Wiimote to see if it's Wii Motion Plus. Otherwise, you might actually end up letting the kids win.
I see.
So there are lessons to be learned. So that's what I've been doing. In terms of what I've been reading, I think we all want a perfect body and we also want a perfect soul. So naturally I read The Creep, by John Arcudi. Deep cuts.
Yeah.
Not that deep cuts. And Jonathan Case, who drew The Green River Killer, which I think we're going to be talking about later. It's an interesting mystery. I feel like there's such a temptation when you do mystery to do sort of a modern gritty thing a la Law and Order, or to do some sort of, you know, crime, 1930s crime noir, you know, dark streets and, you know, dames and madams and all that. And so the fact that this was a murder mystery set in sort of just the late 80s, early 90s, Minnesota, Americana, like the setting alone, I was like, this is different. I'm on board. And it's an interesting sort of thing because it involves two teenage boys who commit suicide within a few months of each other. And they were friends. And of course, the police are like, "Yep, both of them killed themselves. They didn't kill each other. That's not suicide at that point. Both of them killed themselves. There's nothing more to look into." And one of the mothers calls an old friend who is now a PI. He used to be like an insurance claims investigator, and he comes out and starts looking into the case. And it's sort of interesting because they call him the Creep because he had this rare genetic disorder that tends to manifest in one's 30s or 40s, and it sort of distorts facial features into like an exaggerated state. I forget the name of it, but it creates this very distinctive looking protagonist, which I'm sure I think Mike, you've at least seen the cover, so you know what I'm talking about.
I looked at a little bit of the interiors too. It's pretty wild stuff.
It's really cool, and it kind of drifts into this deep, like, Minnesota woods, backwoods mystery tale. And I just read all five or six issues back to back. Very good, very interesting, complete standalone book. So I wouldn't be shocked if a lot of people have just simply never heard of it. And John Arcudi is one of the best writers out there that has just been slogging away for years and just people kind of forget about, just because he never leaves Dark Horse. Or alternatively, I don't think they let him leave Dark Horse. So, John Arcudi, you'll find that exit one day, I swear.
Mm-hmm.
I read Dark Days, the casting. Paul, have you read this yet? Have you read this? Or what's the other one? The Forge?
The Forge, yes. I read them both, and I enjoyed them. They are wonderfully dumb superhero comics in the best way.
Yes.
The perfect kind of dumb comic.
I really liked The Forge for that very reason. I thought the casting, for some reason, which again, same team, so like, what do you expect? I found The Forge to be so wordy, like so talkative. And there's like, my eyes just glaze over after about 7 or 8 pages where it's just pure paragraphs. And I felt like that's what this book did to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we learned a few things, like Duke has, I don't even fully understand what Duke can do, honestly. Did you understand that part?
I mean,
spoilers like, for the Dark Days.
Is he casting? Like an honorary Green Lantern Corps member? Like, what's the deal?
No, that's not what I interpreted.
No, you as. Idiot. Yeah, okay, Paul, I got it. Yeah. Thanks.
Sorry. Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm not entirely sure. It's almost like this ability to kind of read information in a weird way. He's like he could pull up the blueprints for this machine in the Batcave from like memory.
I thought it was sort of insinuating something about the ability to either amplify or negate powers, and that's why his name is Signal.
Okay. Right.
That's why they call him Signal. I don't know.
Anyway,
but we learned that Batman can get a long speech about this mythical dangerous weapon, and which is then given to him by Wonder Woman, and then he promptly goes and pawns it off pages later. Don't let this get into the wrong hands. 2 pages later, hey ex-wife I'll trade you this magical sword for that weird dagger with a lightning bolt on it that looks sweet.
But, yeah.
But you know what? Shazam, man, you know what? If there's anything I can say about The Forge and the casting, it's bringing in weird, dumb characters that I love. Mr. Miracle, Mr. Terrific, Shazam, bring them all back. That's fine.
Yeah, and even this issue, I mean, I love it. I say it's dumb, but I love it because it's like so DC nerdy continuity stuff that I live for. And in that scene where Batman shows up and runs into Talia al Ghul, you have Double X, who is like one of those like most minor characters in Jack Kirby's Fourth World, show up, and I'm like, oh, that's Double X, and he like never gets mentioned again. I think he might have,
I
like,
noticed him from OMAC, and I was like, I know this guy is from something. Okay,
So it's super fun. I mean, it's dumb fun, and I love it.
Yeah, it really has somewhat of a Geoff Johns big bombastic everybody's getting roped in feel, but it's got a Geoff Johns feel with a Scott Snyder prose, which is kind of in some ways why I feel it's a little discordant.
Yeah.
But still, it's a lot of fun. It's a big book. It's a big price, but I still think it's worthwhile. Of course, the jury will be out on just how valuable it is for metal until metal rolls out. So I read Black Hammer 9. Yes, I'm a little bit behind, not trying to rhyme, at least not this time. So we have Matt Kim.
Thanks. This has been the I Read Comic Books podcast. Thank you very much, Nick.
So we got Matt Kent teaming up with his penciler from Ether, David Rubin, and they did an issue about Colonel Weird and Talkie Walkie, which, of course, the character, at least for me, is very much like a Flash Gordon send-up of sorts. And I thought Rubin was a perfect choice to do this sort of, all of these, you know, new and fantastical, strange, colorful worlds, and you know, aliens of all different shapes and sizes, and I thought Rubin was a fantastic choice, and whoever set up that arrangement deserves a cookie. I enjoyed that a lot. What else? Probably the other thing I want to bring up is that I read Rapture number 2. This, of course, is a Valiant miniseries. It's Matt Kent's attempt at injecting sort of a fantasy book into the Valiant universe. I think it was a wise choice. It allows him to sort of access certain characters that otherwise sort of have to... You have to go through some mental gymnastics in order to naturally bring them into other books, such as Shadow Man and such as Punk Mambo. But this whole venture into the Shadow... Good Lord, why am I going to get this wrong? Shadowverse, Shadowlands, Deadside. The Deadside, that's what it's called. This sort of venture into the Deadside allows for some of that to happen. And I appreciate it for that. I also really, really like that it's got Kafu on art. Kafu isn't really well known to some people, but for those of you who read the Rai tie-in issues to 4000 AD, he was the one who took over on Rai at that point, because of course Clayton Crane was busy drawing the actual 4000 AD event book. Yeah. And so there were a lot of people like me, and I think Mike as well, who were sort of very skeptical at seeing Clayton Crane step away from Rai and said, well, hold on, like, let me see your replacement's credentials. Let's see what you've got. And I think Kafu did a really good job. He's a very different artist, different style. But then again, who does look like Clayton Crane art-wise? Like, nobody.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been reading.
Kafu is a fantastic artist. I will say, having him come on to Rai during the 4001 crossover event was a surprise, but also so totally worth it. I was glad to still be getting Clayton Crane art, but Kafu's art on Rai was seriously top notch. I just want to make sure that's said, because holy cow, I think I talked about this when it came out, but man, that guy totally talented.
Yeah.
Anyways, so. Paul, what's up with you? How have you been? How have comic books been? All that.
Well, I have been good, and I have been trying to keep up. I feel like I always am falling behind on my weekly books, but past week was just catching up, and I managed to do that. So a few of the highlights that I read were Power Man, which is not the Marvel Comics Luke Cage Power Man, but instead a mini comic by Box Brown that I happened to find at a little comic shop when I was in LA a couple weeks ago. The titular character Power Man is actually a character named Gary Biesch, who bears more than a passing resemblance to noted real estate mogul and reality TV show star Donald Trump. It's a pretty timely book. It came out back last March, so long before, you know, things happened. But it's a pretty fun character study. I mean, it's Box Brown, so it's got that sort of lighthearted artwork, but there's a sort of a sad emotional core to it. I really enjoyed it. I also read Love and Rockets number 3 by Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez, newly inducted into the Eisner Hall of Fame this past SDCC. Much deserved.
Yes. Now, who's publishing the new run?
It's Fantagraphics still.
Okay.
But, you know, they switched from doing, for like 7 or 8 years, they were doing like annual collections where every year they'd put out like a 100-page trade of their new stuff. They went back to, it's not quite monthly, it's more quarterly, more or less, series. And what's interesting is they returned to that, and they returned to like a bigger like magazine size format rather than the normal comic size.
Yeah.
And the story that Jaime is telling in these first 3 issues is about Maggie and her friend Hopi going back to their old neighborhood, going and seeing a punk show, running into all their old friends. So there's sort of nostalgia going on in the story, as well as the actual physical format of the book, which I really thought was interesting. And, you know, something about Jaime Hernandez's art, it's just, I love getting it on a regular basis again. Every few months, it's like an old friend you're revisiting. There's like one panel in one of his stories where you just have Maggie and Hopi, the two like main characters of his whole 35-year-long Love and Rockets story. And the panel is just them looking at each other, and there's no background. It's just them, but their posture and the look on their faces, it's like their entire relationship in like one image. And it's just moments like that really make me appreciate the Hernandez's work so much.
Mm-hmm. So it's always this book just sounds like a total snooze fest. I'm just going to let it. I'm just messing with you. How do you feel about the new run relative to this grand expansive of work, Paul? Where do you sort of place it, or how do you feel about it?
Hernandez's work, their catalog that they've developed over the past three decades is, I think it stands alone, not just in comics, but in like any type of art form or pop culture. I mean, it's really impressive the fact that they've been doing this for so long and so consistently. And Gilbert's stuff is weird, and I've never quite gotten my finger on it, but I like reading it. But Jaime's stuff, I mean, it's a 35-year-long soap opera that he's done on his own with pencil and ink, and it's always amazing to see it. So the new series, like I said, it's this nostalgia trip, but it's not a pure, like, hey, we're going to go back to the old neighborhood. There's the whole weight of the 35 years that come before are still there with you. So
okay.
I don't know. It's an achievement that I think is remarkable, not just in comics, but like I said, in all of pop culture. So I also read Black Bolt number 3 and 4. Like I said, I was catching up on some stuff. This is, of course, mm-hmm. the Black Bolt series by Saladin Ahmed with art by Christian Ward. This book is awesome. I don't know what else I can say about it. It's a perfect concept. You have a magical space prison that Black Bolt has to break out of with the yes. help of the Absorbing Man, Crusher Creel. It's great stuff. Issue 4 is pretty interesting because it actually is kind of like almost like a solo issue. It's just Crusher Creel sharing his life story with Black Bolt. So you get to know that Absorbing Man character a little bit more. It's good stuff.
Who is Crusher Creel?
He's the Absorbing Man.
Okay.
an old Avengers villain from mm-hmm. Way back in the 60s.
Okay, sure. I mean,
Nick, this is one of those Marvel books that I think I'm going to be pushing on you really hard to pick up yeah. on in trade. I think you'll yeah. really enjoy it, given you really don't need to know much about either of these characters going in. True. Like, even why Black Bolt is in this prison is still kind of a mystery to everyone reading the book right now. So, I mean, all you need to really know is he's the king of the Inhumans, but he's in this prison, ? And that's yeah. the beginning of the book.
I mean, mm-hmm. I've seen the covers for this book. It's one of those books where the covers are so good, I could just buy the book and never read it and be like, look at this piece of art. And then totally. People are like, there are other pages inside there. There's a story. And who cares? Just look at this.
It is a very good book. It is a very good yeah. book. And it really, as someone that doesn't read a lot of Marvel, it's one of those books that stands out for the main continuity enough for me to really enjoy, not worry about it. Crossing over right. at all. So
those are the books I need, you know.
Yeah,
exactly.
Moon Knight.
also read Doom Patrol number 7. This was a issue with fill-in art by Mike Allred. It's weird to say Mike Allred is a fill-in artist because he's so, you know, well-known outside of that. But
yeah.
he did the art on this issue, and it kind of is a perfect fit because it's kind of like a retro flashback type issue where Ooh. The Doom Patrol meet back up with the Chief, Niles Calder, and he makes them put on all their old uniforms that they wore in the 60s comic and have a sort of like madcap fighting a supervillain type adventure. It's really fun, kind of meta, exactly what you want from the Doom Patrol. And then finally, the highlight of my comic book reading week was, of course, KFC Across the Universe number 3.
Wait, this is out? This is yep. out?
It came out during the yes, San Diego
yes,
Comic Con.
Yes, yep. yes, yes, it, yes.
It's of course... number 3 in the hopefully continuing never ending DC
please and- god DC you can cancel all of your other books, it doesn't matter, just spare yeah. this one.
Please always make a Kentucky Fried Chicken crossover promotional comic once a year. I love this stuff. I can't even explain why. I love this book. I love this whole thing. It's Tony Bedard writing it, Tom Dinarik on art, and I think this was probably my favorite one so far, honestly. Tony Bedard.
Oh, really?
Well, it's based on the like Green Lantern, and Tony Bedard did a long run on Green Lantern Corps. So I think it's kind of in his wheelhouse.
True.
The setup is that the Colonel is trying to promote his new chicken zinger sandwiches, so he sends one up into outer space on a space shuttle, and he says, well, the biggest way to promote it would be to send out thousands of chicken zinger sandwiches across the universe. So he enlists the help of the Green Lantern Corps to send out these chicken zinger sandwiches across the known universe. And the problem is that when the containers containing the chicken zinger sandwiches are opened, they're empty. Someone stole all the chicken zinger sandwiches. So the Colonel,
I thought the bigger problem is now there's just a massive amount of like space junk, you know, just yeah, they, out there yeah. drifting, you know.
They conveniently overlook that. But then The Colonel gets basically deputized into the Green Lantern Corps, and him and Hal Jordan have to go find out who stole the chicken zinger sandwiches.
Awesome.
It's perfect. I don't know why. I can't remember the last time I've ever eaten KFC. I don't eat meat. But something about these promotional comics just touch something in me that I really enjoy. They're just dumb, fun, and they're free. What's not to like? So
that's amazing. I'm what still waiting you, on that KFC. Yeah, yeah. For me, oh boy. Well, I did read a lot. Like, I actually have been sitting down and trying to get through my literal bookshelf of backlog books that I have that don't include my floppies that are sitting on my desk right now, and doesn't include my humongous list of digital books that I have. But I've been telling myself I got to get through stuff. So I did go and tackle a bunch of stuff. But here are my highlights, I guess. I read all of Mercury Heat, number 1 through 12, because I feel like I owe it to Tia to actually read that book, despite it being canceled or over or whatever it was. This is a book by Kieran Gillen and Omar Francia, and holy cow, this is like balls to the wall, police procedural, gonna kick you in the throat and make your head explode kind of comic. Like, it's the perfect mashup of a really cool police drama in space that also happens to have a ton of violence in it. So it fits right into the Avatar wheelhouse in that regard. But the story is pretty cool. Like, it there's a very, really, very rich universe that the story exists in. We follow a woman whose name I can't remember, but she wants to be a beat cop, or she wants to be a police. She keeps calling herself, "I want to be a police," which reminds me a lot of The Wire. It's really great in that regard. It feels just like a police like show on Showtime or HBO. She wants to be a police, but it turns out she's got this weird personality type, because in this super futuristic world, everyone's personality gets judged and you get a certain number, and she's a 57B, and the B is important, and I don't know why, because the story ended, but nonetheless, she becomes a police officer on the planet Mercury, where humans are basically mining all of the energy and all these different minerals and things from this planet and sending it back to Earth and keeping the people alive on Mercury. And there's this big conspiracy going on, and she's got to solve it, even though she's kind of just a beat cop who gets hired for these very violent jobs because that's what her personality type is. She is a person who's supposed to be a soldier, someone who can inflict pain and kill others, but she wants to be a police. It's fucking amazing. Like, I was so riveted. Like, I was so like pulled into the story by issue 2, I couldn't stop reading. I read all 12 issues in a sitting. This book was just terribly underrated. Tia was 100% right. I just want to make sure that she was selling this book on the show for months. She was 100% right. I had to kind of distance myself from Avatar, but I guess I was totally wrong. This book was amazing. I highly recommend it if you can get your hands on it. I also read 7 to Eternity number 8, which was my pick last week, I should say. I was not disappointed. The story kind of twisted and went back on beat of the we've got to kill this Mud King, and they fixed all the character problems. I don't know. I'm back on 7 to Eternity. I feel like I'm going to be like this for the rest of the series, so take everything I say with a grain of salt at this point regarding this book. I did read... Oh, the art for this book was actually different. James Herron and Matt Hollingsworth did the pencils and inks and colors, which is different from Jeremy Opina, who normally is on the art. But he was a good fill-in. I'm ready to have Opina back, though, because his art is the best. I did read Batman number 28. This is Tom King and Michael Janin. Holy shit, the art in this book is worth it enough. You could get rid of all the words. I just want the art. Yeah. The story is really, really cool, but holy shit, the art is amazing. I don't really know what else to say about Batman right now, because we're in the middle of this Jokes and Riddles storyline, and it's really, really cool. I'm ready to see it play out. Really excited to see how things get flash-forwarded back to the future, where Batman and Catwoman are kind of chilling, and Batman is telling this story, so... I don't remember how long this arc is going to be, but it's pretty good. I'm really digging Batman, which is, again, a surprise to 10 years ago, Mike. I don't think I'd ever would say that. So,
right.
Yeah, definitely digging it. Green River Killer. Nick has been harping on me. I need to read this book for the longest time, so I finally went and bought it. This is a story by Jeff Jensen with art by Jonathan Case. Green River Killer is a graphic novelization of the story of the detective who basically captured the Green River Killer in Seattle back in the 80s. It's a whole story that spans almost 30 years. It's really, really put together. Like, I was so impressed by the end of this book. Like, again, this is one of those stories I sat down and I could not stop reading. And when you get to the final, I guess, chapter of the book, because it's broken up into chapters, but it's a big graphic novel, my heart just broke in two. And the story ends in such a satisfying way that I you got to read this. This is a really beautiful nonfiction story that Jeff Jensen, who turns out is the son of the detective who actually captured the Green River Killer, it's so well done. I highly recommend this if you want a nonfiction book that just gets you. It's got crime, it's got intrigue, it's got a lot of really interesting flashbacks.
It's also got a very personal, two very personal stories.
Yeah, and it's a very personal story about this detective and how he's been working this case for almost 30 years, and it's become his entire life's work. And to see it actually come to fruition and capture the guy, it's so satisfying. I mean, spoilers for the story because this thing happened in real life, but you got to read this. This is a very interesting book. Finally, I did read Motor Crush by Babstar, Brendan Fletcher, and Cameron Stewart, art by Babstar and Cameron Stewart, but they all collaborated on the story. This book took me by total surprise because I did not expect it to do anything that it did. Really, I read issue one when it first came out because I think Xander or Tia were telling me, like, this is one of those top-notch books out there. Mm-hmm. It didn't really catch me, but I promised myself I'd pick up the trade, and so I did. I actually sat down and read it, and by issue four, the book was a completely different story in the sense that it's in the same vein. I did not say this is one of those books that like promises one thing and delivers another, but they kick the entire story up to 11 by the fourth and fifth issue, okay, to the point where I'm definitely addicted. Like, I'm considering, I think I either need to pick this up in singles or do something to read this book because, man, oh man, I am anxiously anticipating volume two. Like, okay, it's itching my skin.
Yeah, interesting, because I remember reading the first issue and liking it, but not being sold completely. So that's exciting to know that maybe if I stuck with it or pick up the trade, it's worthwhile. Cool.
Yeah, I think if you liked the first issue but you didn't continue, you need to get the trade. It's so worth it.
Good. I'll check it out.
But all right. But anyways, let's move on. We're already taking up enough time. This isn't going to be like a 4.5-hour episode like last week. So let's get into our comic picks. Comics come out on August 9th, 2017. What are you guys excited for? Let's start with you, Paul.
It's probably no surprise to anybody. My pick this week is Mr. Miracle number 1 by Tom King and Mitch Gerads. I think I'm never sure how to pronounce that last name. But
yeah.
That's, the creative team from Sheriff of Babylon, which is great. And, of course, mm-hmm. Tom King is kind of the patron writer of this podcast, it seems at times, since we kind of like everything he does.
Yeah.
But so you have that creative team doing one of my very favorite DC characters, Mr. Miracle. I cannot wait for this book. As soon as it was announced, even before it was formally announced, when Tom King was just tweeting out random images that are apparently of the new gods or of Mr. Miracle, I was like, whatever book he's doing, I'm buying. So it's finally here. I guess if for anyone that doesn't know, Mr. Miracle, the gimmick is that he's a super escape artist. And he ties into the larger Jack Kirby fourth world mythology because he was raised on the planet Apocalypse, came to Earth. He was the only person ever to escape Apocalypse, hence the super escape artist, you know, moniker. He comes to Earth and he actually becomes an escape artist. Like, that's his job. He puts on shows. He's a magician and then manages to, you know, hang out with the Justice League and other superheroes. He has a home life. He's
that
happily
really
married.
Gives me faith for like the future of like extraterrestrial encounters. Oh, what are they going to contribute to our society? Well, he's basically going to perform a, you know, wrangling, you know, Barnum and Bailey circus act of sorts.
You always need that. But the core of the character is actually, I think, his relationship with his wife, Big Barda, one of the coolest characters ever created. They have a very like stable, loving marriage relationship, which seems kind of rare in comics. You know, she hasn't ended up in a refrigerator like some girlfriends, unfortunately. And they're happily married. And I think I've always read that as Jack Kirby's fictionalized version of his own life. Like, he's happily married, and my wife is the one that takes care of the business aspect, why I can be creative, and that's basically maps onto Mr. Miracle pretty well. So, given Tom King's work on The Vision, which I just read the first volume of and absolutely loved, I think he can crush any type of domesticated life type story like this. Obviously, there's going to be a little bit more to it than just two happily married people, but that's what I'm along the ride to see. I cannot wait for this book. I'm so excited, and all the advanced buzz and advanced reviews have been super glowing. I think it's going to be not even a dark horse surprise hit. I think it's going to be a huge book across the board.
That's awesome. This was going to be my pick as well, and I realized that you were on the show. I couldn't pick it.
Right. Well, thanks.
Nick, what about you?
Look, that was going to be my pick too. Okay. Jesus. I mean, I think what's really interesting is that King has shown that he's very familiar and comfortable with this idea of the 12-issue maxi series. Yet, like, Omega Men was this weird, come out of nowhere, absolute, absolute surprise hit. People are like, what the fuck is this? I would even say the Omega Men are like infinitely more obscure than Mr. Miracle is, yeah, honestly. Yeah. So it's kind of weird because, like, here's King doing the same sort of thing, but definitely more well-known character. Definitely, thankfully, you know, it's very topical because, of course, Kirby and whatnot and his 100th birthday. But it will be interesting to see how this goes, considering that I think the expectation and the, you know, knowledge about this going in is so much higher than last time. So, yeah. But, you know, I take picks of the week very seriously as my opportunity to give a book a leg up that it so desperately would not have without my assistance. So I said,
the
show must go on. I still got to find something else. And my phone's always ringing off the hook. Nick, we need your help. Stop reading my book, please. Don't talk about it. So I just want to quickly plug Grass King 6, Boom Comics, Matt Kent writing, Tyler Jenkins doing the art, watercolors. I honestly don't know how in the world or where in the world this issue is going to go. For a book that is very grounded in the real world and sort of rural America, I guess you could say, like, the last issue more or less turned this sort of do what you want, live how you want, we're free from the law and government interference sort of utopia of sorts, and basically turned it into a war zone. Matt Kent went and basically played Chorus of the Bells all over this book, and not one of them is going to get unrung anytime soon. I have no idea where this book is going. I don't know if Matt Kent got a weird idea and figured he was going to wrap this up at issue 6, because after 5, like, I don't honestly know where this is going to go. So, again, if you haven't read it, I don't know where the trade's going to roll out. I don't know really where they're going to cut this book to put it into a trade. But definitely, definitely, definitely pick this up, especially because with the first couple issues really having a bit of a slow burn effect, I think in trade, the tolerance for getting through that will be a lot smoother.
Yeah, this is one of those books that I definitely want to pick up in trade, if only because I'm already buying too many Matt Kent books. So, you know what? He can have my money later on this one. For me this week, I am reading, I'm very excited for Redlands number 1 by Jordi Belair and Vanessa Del Rey. This is a horror book from Jordi Belair, and at this point, I just want to support Jordi Belair and anything that she does. She has done right so many times, I can't imagine that she could ever really do wrong. So I'm going to pick this book up. I'm not really into horror comics, but at the same time, Vanessa Del Rey's art is fucking top-notch, and I've never read anything by Jordi Belair, at least that I can think of. So I'm really excited to see how this book turns out. Like, I know nothing about it other than it's a horror book in Florida. So we'll see.
And
I'm
just
looking
to be
at the
absolutely
image
clear for our listeners, Mike, we are talking about the typically a colorist Jordi Belair moving into a writing role.
Yes. I'm looking at the image solicit or the image post. It says the police are failing to maintain control of their old fashioned town, and a coven of killer witches plans to take everything from them. So the final line is, this summer, hide your Bibles. So I'm on board. Let's see how this turns out. again, I'm totally excited for a book like this, like just to give Jordi Belair a try for sure. I'm really hoping that this kicks butt. And the praise on the Image page is already really great. Scott Snyder is totally loving it. Tom King, Warren Ellis's review is nice fucking job. So I can get on board with that. These people may all be biased because I'm pretty sure she's colored all their books. But that being said, I'm gonna trust this book. I'm definitely gonna go in with my bar very, very high. Because horror is, like I said, is not my genre. So we'll see how this turns out. I have a feeling I'm gonna love it. Just from the cover alone. It looks real gruesome and that could be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Quote unquote fun.
Yeah, the same way that, you know, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina was fun. Our show this week is all about DC Rebirth, but not so much about the stories within DC Rebirth. About DC Rebirth as a product, as a thing. We've talked about DC Rebirth a ton on the show. Right after it was announced, we did little mini like episodes about Rebirth and what it means for DC readers. And now that we're a year in, the question is, how's it doing? How is everything going? What are the surprises? What are the pitfalls? Where do we see DC excelling? Where do we see DC kind of falling behind? Put this on our show schedule a while back, and I think for the last 2 or 3 weeks, Nick has been frantically writing notes and spending all of his time thinking about this when he's not working and sleeping. So let's start with Nick. What are your initial thoughts? And when that half hour is over, Nick and I will talk, or Paul and I will talk.
Yeah, you guys can go, you know, watch two showings of Titanic back to back and then the extended cut version of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And probably about halfway through that second showing of Return of the King, I should be done.
Okay, good. How has DC Rebirth actually been like for you as a big DC fan? I think we've got our, you know, people on the show in different camps of the stuff that they primarily read or they can talk about. And you've always been more of a DC person. As a person who, you know, probably went full in on Rebirth, how has it been for you this last year?
Yeah, well, I mean, first, Michael, I want to go back and qualify things. I wouldn't say that I'm so much of like a hardcore DC fanboy, and I know those weren't your words, and I would also say, I mean, Paul, you can correct me, but I think both of us sort of, we know where to draw the line, like, when DC's being ridiculous, and we're not, like, there are people who buy every single DC book, and it doesn't matter who's on it, it doesn't matter if it's good, it doesn't matter if it's bad, it doesn't matter if it crosses over, like, people are just on autopilot for that, and I think Paul and I sort of know where to draw the line.
That's right. Not what I was implying.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of important because I know some people when they hear, you know, so-and-so is such a huge fanboy, then it's like, all right, grain of salt with everything. And I think at least on some level, Paul and I are sort of even-keeled when it comes to the bullshit that a big two publisher can put out. But that being said, I mean, let me just quick give the like 30-second primer for those who aren't aware. So DC Rebirth began on May 25th, 2016, with the release of DC Universe Rebirth Special Number 1. That was a big oversized one-shot by Geoff Johns and a handful of artists. And I think they were selling it for like $2, and it was a massive deal. It was a very smart way to get people in.
Oh, yeah.
And I think a lot of people were asking, well, what was this set to accomplish? And I think for the most part, and Paul, disagree if you want, but more or less the core thing was opening the door for literally anything in the DC universe, in the legacy of DC, to come streaming through, basically. New 52 was much more about putting things in a box and keeping that box in isolation. And sort of making a very self-contained world. And Rebirth was much more about saying DC has this rich and robust and confusing and annoying and also confusing legacy, and we want to open the door to virtually the possibility of any of that coming through. And that's basically what Rebirth did. And yeah, so, of course, when people heard that, a lot of the old school fans were very happy. and a lot of the newer-ish readers got a little bit scared and said, hold on, like, what's going on here? So beyond that, Rebirth accomplished a few other brief things I'm just going to go through here. Issues were attempted to keep issues at $2.99 for all books. That being said, that didn't stay true because the books that came out once a month were then bumped up to $3.99 with a digital copy, which brings me to the other point, which was that DC decided that they were going to put out significantly less books than the New 52, and they were going to double ship the more popular titles. So that's basically the core tenet of DC. Big characters, more books about those big characters, lower prices, but double shipping, and the bringing back the original issue numberings for Detective and Action Comics. And those are sort of, at least for me, the core elements of what Rebirth started as, basically.
It's interesting to compare that to what they did with the New 52, which is basically a hard reboot. Rebirth felt like a little bit of a softer reboot where you had a lot of creative teams change and you had new number ones, but it was less of a harsh, we're starting from scratch as the New 52 was. And I think that's the reason Rebirth has succeeded, at least in my eyes, in terms of the product. You have some shakeups on the creative teams and you had new takes on characters. And I think one thing we talked about maybe on the show when we talked about the Rebirth when it started was like the books felt action-packed. There was a sense of dynamism to the books. There's some forward movement. The stories were engaging, which felt very different from the New 52 relaunch. And I think the successes for me with Rebirth are those titles like Batman and Superman and Batwoman, where you had new creative teams and sort of not new takes on the characters, but a willingness to take the characters places they hadn't been before. And I think those are the reasons that those are the books I'm still reading are Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, because of that approach where you do have an approach that says, we're not going to be stuck in a hard line continuity. We're going to be more open with the characters and take them different places. And that's why those books have succeeded. I can't really speak to the rest of the lines. Those are really the only books I've been reading since the beginning. But the overall sense I get is that sort of new push for different types of creative team matchups is why Rebirth has succeeded in the way that New 52 didn't.
Yeah, exactly. And and for me, I went into Rebirth, and this goes back to what I was saying, I went into Rebirth only reading Batman, All-Star Batman, The Hellblazer, and Green Arrow. And I think that's it. Yeah, that sounds about right. And as for where things currently stand, and we'll get at this later, because Rebirth hasn't canceled any of those books, I myself canceled The Hellblazer, but that's been it. I found the rest to be very solid, and The Hellblazer really just suffered from some art shuffling that I didn't really enjoy. A move away from the introductory artist who wasn't even on rotation but just never came back, and just some questionable issues in that regard. And that sort of touches at like my other, I think what was really my big question for Rebirth, which was, we're talking about double shipping, we're talking about rotating artist teams on books. How well is this going to be executed? How sustainable is it going to be? I remember we were talking at the time about how certain books were already had like a third artist that was waiting in the wings, maybe even a fourth artist that was going to be waiting in the wings. How is this going to shape the look and feel of books? And did it feel like it was just going to be a very like piecemeal, you know, here's two inkers, three colorists, and four pencilers getting this other issue out on time?
Yeah.
And I remember being very scared, very cynical about this. And I admit it sometimes when I'm wrong, but I was completely wrong. So far, I have been very, very, very impressed with how well this has been done. My Green Arrow book, Juan Ferreira and Otto Schmidt on art, both of them look pretty different from one another, but both of them really well match the tone of the book. They do tend to switch back and forth between arcs. I think that helps with the consistency. Yes, it has had, I think, I can't remember her last name, but Elena something has done a little bit of fill-in pencils, but it hasn't been gratuitous. It hasn't been excessive. With Batman, you had a back and forth between Michael Janin and David Finch, and I feel like that has also been very consistent. Not a lot of extra people coming into the midst. In fact, I had maybe only Clay Mann to help with one issue, and that was it.
I mean, although what a beautiful issue that was.
Didn't Rossmo technically draw the Batman issues during the Monster Men?
Yeah, he did. He did.
Anyway, yeah, he did. We're splitting hairs, and Rossmo Rossmo comes onto my book. That's a blessing. That's not a curse. I don't care.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think they've managed that rotating artist thing really, really well. I don't know about you guys.
The only shakeup that I really had was the Hellblazer, for instance. You know, I think they were rotating like two or three artists in on that book, and it got really hard to follow. And ultimately, like the story wasn't as riveting to me as some of the other books, like Batman, for instance. I mean, we're gonna say Batman a lot in this episode. I'm really sorry, but that book is really the like golden gem right now, and I think that goes to Tom King for top notch writing. This is the Tom King Show. Thank you for listening. But ultimately, like I was reading the Flash. I think I dropped the Flash at issue 24. The only problem I had with that book is the swap was really weird, where they would go three issues on, three issues off, and then it became really inconsistent, and they had a third artist jump in for a second. And I was really hoping to get a 6-6 break, because if you're changing artists in the middle of an arc, kind of is funky if the art styles aren't the same. And I think when it first happened in Flash, I was a little off put, but it wasn't so bad. In the later issues, I kind of wasn't feeling the art. I kind of wasn't feeling the story. So the art thing really started my, like, I guess, downward spiral in how much I really wanted to read that book.
Sure.
And I mean, I'm not trying to say that that's a bad book. I think it's a solid Flash book, but I definitely lost interest. And the art didn't help that. I mean, the art changes, I should say, because the art was actually very, very good. Like, don't get me wrong. I think Carmen DeMarco, I can never say his last name. His art is probably some of my favorite out there in comics. But the swap-ins and swap-outs, you'd get some inconsistency in characters. And that can, like, again, I think that is the biggest off-putting thing when you've got those weird schedules. I know there was a lot of, I don't want to say uproar, but I know there's a lot of people talking about the changes and how they did things in Wonder Woman, where it was every issue it was an opposite artist, and they were telling separate stories, and that's fine, but I think that that's very jarring for readers sometimes, especially if they're looking for just a straightforward story. And I'm not trying to discredit people by saying that they can't follow it, but I could see how that could be problematic, where you've got 2 months between issues, or you've got, you would only have a month between stories, but you're still reading two books side by side about the same character, following maybe relatively similar storylines to try to do a parallel plot. So I don't know. I know that a lot of people had a problem with that, too. So that's another example that I heard of.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading Wonder Woman for a while, I guess, and I had that issue. I didn't think it detracted from the book, but I just found it distracting in a weird way, personally. And I think that kind of is a disadvantage, because one of the stories they were telling was a great sort of Wonder Woman year one type origin story with Greg Rucka writing it. Who was on art? I think Nicola Scott was.
Scott or Sharp was the other one that was alternating.
So I think it was Scott was doing the year one, and it's a perfect creative team, right? Rucka and Scott doing Wonder Woman. It was great. Yeah. And I think there's a disadvantage with them interspicing the current time story with that, with the double shipping. I have to imagine that when they did the first trade, they just collected the year one stuff.
That's exactly what happened. I was just about to say, if you want to ask how DC felt about how well people were going to process that. Yeah, the trades are coming out with just the Scott and one, and just the Sharp and the other. Yeah.
Well, I think part of that has to be the success of the movie. They want to have a book they can sell to new fans. And that year one, that origin story, that's a perfect jump on point for new fans who saw the movie. So that's a smart way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe that speaks to the issue of double shipping, which it's a double-edged sword, because on one hand, I really love getting two issues of Batman a month, but I don't think it suits the Superman book very well.
Really?
I just don't think
Really?
Yeah, I think maybe it's the current story that's going on right now. I find it, it's not paced very well for a double shipped book. And Tom King's Batman, there have been a few issues where I think, you know, maybe this was a part of, this could have been a single issue, but it's split into two. I noticed those things with double shipped books. And the other issue is that that eats up two books that I could be adding to my pull list. You know what I mean? I'm working on a budget, so double shipping Batman and Superman means those are two DC or other books that I'm not reading that I could be.
And of course, they tried to lessen that blow by, you know, locking things in at $3. So you're spending $6 instead of $8. But yes, your point stands. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
I was going to say, the weird thing for me is that my biggest suspicion was going to be, just look, the books that come out once a month are going to be like evenly paced and perfectly fine, and the double shipped books are going to feel like a hot mess. And oddly for me, I feel like a lot of the double shipped books, I'm enjoying them a lot more than the single shipped books. Okay. Then again, like, I know most people aren't reading Green Arrow, and that book is just absolutely fantastic right now. I think the best kept secret about that book, and I think I even said this on the show last week, is that it really is a team book with Black Canary and with Diggle and Emiko, his younger half-sister, and Fifth, his tech expert. I've really, really enjoyed that. I think that's probably been the biggest surprise. All-Star Batman has been... I sort of feel like Scott Snyder's editor could have like laid into him a little bit harder with that book. I feel like they let him get a little loose, and it waxes really poetic at certain points when maybe it doesn't need to be. But I feel like that's really an apples and oranges sort of book with these different rotational artists and sort of these villain a month looks at things. But you know what? Any book that gets me like Tula Lote, Jock, Raphael Albuquerque, who else? I think Giuseppe Carmuncoli did the Mad Hatter issue. Like any book that's getting me all of this fantastic art within just a few months of one another, like you really can't go wrong there. Right. So I've really enjoyed Rebirth. I think when you hear just the general, from the media outlets that I consume, I should put it that way, from the ones I pay attention to, I've felt that everyone is like, oh man, DC's doing it right, so to speak, and Marvel, what a mess. Marvel doesn't know what they're doing. Nick, is one always juxtaposed with the other? Yes. No, you cannot talk about one without belittling the other. It's, you know, it's written down there. It's like the 12th commandment, if you were to pay attention or something.
Right.
But yeah, that's my general consensus. I think it's really interesting when you know, compare that with the statistics and whatnot. But
yeah, I mean, and speaking, I guess, Paul, I'll give you a chance to answer the same question, even though I feel like you've probably said a lot of what you wanted to say. But has Rebirth been working for you as a, I guess, longtime DC fan? I'm not saying you're a DC fanboy and that's all you care about and yada yada, but I know that you read DC more
Paul
than
I do. Paul is grounded. Paul is a grounded fan. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
I'm a critical fan. I'll put it that
sure,
way.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think I've really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I enjoyed the New 52 relaunch. I think what's interesting about Rebirth for me is, on one hand, it's a line-wide relaunch, but at the same time, the books kind of feel more or less self-contained. And part of that is because they haven't had a line-wide crossover until Metal, which I think starts next month.
But aside from Justice League Suicide Squad, which was semi-line.
There have been mini crossovers, but not an event that
Paul's talking big scale.
Yeah.
Like, I think, summer, I think epic that, yeah. summer event.
I yeah. think, and that's what I've enjoyed about it, is that, there was the crossover between Batman and Flash, which hinted at a larger issue of Rebirth, which is the Watchmen apparently are showing up. Or not the Watchmen, but Watchmen characters are showing up. And you have, in the background of this whole Rebirth, you have a sort of continuity-wide issue that's being teased, but it's not driving the creative elements of the individual titles. Whereas, again, and I'm someone that only knows of Marvel tangentially because I don't read a lot of those titles, and the titles I do read, as I mentioned earlier, are sort of outside of the main continuity. But it feels like as long as I've been back reading comics regularly again for the past maybe like 10 years now, Marvel's just in a constant event push, right? There's always an event happening around the cusp. Yeah.
At some point, your book's going to hit an event is pretty much what it comes down to.
Yeah.
No book is safe. unless you've got a book like The Vision, or you've got like a miniseries, or your Star Wars, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I think DC's been smart that way, where the New 52, they had crossovers right away. This
Night Rebirth, of the Court of Owls, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. And Rebirth, more or less, has been crossover free, and the big one that's coming up is Metal, which... it doesn't even feel like a line-wide crossover to me, because I think it's more or less self-contained in a miniseries. It's one creative team doing it, and it doesn't have the same stink of a big event or the same sense of event fatigue that I had in the past. Maybe just because it hasn't been a big one in a while, but across the board, I think as a DC fan and someone that loves nerdy, deep continuity stuff, Rebirth has been hitting that button for me, but not laying into it too hard, if that makes sense, if that metaphor works.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, to go back to Nick's point saying that people think it's a success, I mean, looking at the numbers, do we think so? I know, Nick, you pulled some numbers. Comic-Con is a beautiful, beautiful website that exists out there to calculate statistics and various pieces of information about the comic industry from a numbers standpoint. And I know that you went through and you kind of combed through the last year's worth of sales from DC, specifically regarding, you know, three major books, Batman, Green Arrow, and Aquaman, which I think we can almost rank as top selling, mid-tier selling, and low selling. How do the numbers factor into this to say, like, is this successful? Is it only successful for the, you know, the Trinity, you know, of Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman? Maybe Justice League is thrown in there? Or does it seem like a wide line, like medium success, not hitting all number ones every month, but hitting at least the top 10 or 15?
Yeah. No, I hear you. I mean, the first thing is, like, could I have done more? Like, wow, there's, like, Nick's driving mantra right there. But, yeah, I didn't go with any books that weren't double shipped. I didn't have time to get into that. I also didn't go with anything that I thought was going to be, like, really in trouble. Cough, Blue Beetle.
Okay.
And, of course, the problem with Aquaman is that since Geoff Johns really made him bigger during the New 52, he's not as much of a bench warmer as he used to be. But that being said, yeah, if you want to look at Rebirth on a very broad scale, there are some like major salient points to bring up, especially in terms of sales, which first off the bat, you know, here's Rebirth. We're launching with a very, very, very small amount of books, you know, relative to the New 52 here. You know, we're talking about... gosh, what did I say? 29?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, 29. Mm-hmm.
So we've got Rebirth coming out. We've only got 29 books instead of 52. Over the course of the next year, we are going to only add 3 books. Over the course of the New 52's first year, they added 10 books. I don't know if some people either remember or didn't know, but one of the big mantras of the New 52, and I think they abandoned it later on, was that there will always be 52 books. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how many we cancel, we will replace each and every single one of them. But so with Rebirth, we start with 29, we add 3 over the next year, and 2 of those books were even mentioned at the very beginning when all the Rebirth titles were announced. They were just big stragglers. So if you want to talk about Rebirth having a master plan, even most of those itty-bitty amount of additions, those were planned. But since then, no cancellations, largely no additions, which is very, very interesting, especially when you want to talk about sales. No books are getting rebooted. No books are getting canceled. There's really no opportunity to get some new number ones in there to pad up the sales or bounce things back. And at least for me, like the figures make sense. And you always have to go with a big picture glance at things, because you can really never look at the, you know, obviously you can basically take any of the numbers for new number ones and just throw it out the window. It means nothing. It means absolutely nothing. Just throw it in the trash, okay? Because it's just... It's nothing. If you want to say, wow, that's a really great flash in the pan, welcome to Marvel's playbook, okay? Because they know that.
Right.
And you have to look at the drop off to number two. And even then, like for me at least, a lot of the number two figures, those things almost go in the trash for me as well. It's like, okay, like let's give it 2 or 3 months. Then we'll see where you're at. And at least for me, it looks like DC depreciation is pretty in line with what it should be. You know, Batman number one sold 280,000 copies. That dropped to 177,000 by number two. And again, you can just largely throw that out the window. But by number six, it was still selling 138. And to go from 177 to 138 over the course of 4 issues, especially so early on issues, that's pretty good. I think that's still a success.
You're still holding on to, you know, 50% of your readers based on the number one, almost. So, like...
Yeah, when you're holding 50% of a new number one, 6 issues out, yeah, that's good.
And so, I guess, and so Batman is kind of like, I ranked them earlier saying we've got 3 options here, Batman, Green Arrow, and Aquaman. Green Arrow's numbers are kind of surprising, and in fact, by, like, even by issue 6... just looking at these stats, and I'll actually post a Google Doc to this in our show notes if anyone's interested, with some links to Comicron just for anyone who really wants to get into the numbers. But like, you're looking at Green Arrow number one with just under 70,000 in sales. Number two, 72,000. And
but don't ask me how that happened. I don't understand that part.
That's very strange.
Yeah, I wonder if the TV show had something to do with it. I don't know, because it's not like it premiered until September anyways. But by issue number 6 of Green Arrow, we're looking at 55,000. And that's a serious hold on in, you know, over 3 months, to say that they had almost 70% of their readers still there. But by issue 24, which came out in June, they're down to 27,000. So I'm wondering, like, where did those readers go? Did we lose people? I mean, Nick, you said you do read this book, so maybe you have some insight into that. But if you compare it to Batman, by issue 24, there was like a weird thing, and this is where the Catwoman story comes in and may have a factor into it. Batman was still holding 116,000 readers compared to the 138 for number six. So that's like a very consistent plateau that I think DC likes to see. With a book like this, whereas Green Arrow, we see like a definite dive, which usually means a book is not doing so hot. So I guess, I don't know, was there some significant change in Green Arrow that you think could have caused that? Or is this just natural drop off?
Yeah, like that's, like I said earlier, that's what's so frustrating for me is before, you know, I looked at any of this information, I would have said, you know, I feel pretty good about everything. Green Arrow did have a slight amount of fill-in work. The arcs did get a little bit longer, but it was still just your regular injection of new elements and new characters and things like that. And so there's nothing I can really point at. But, you know, the real question from there is you look at Batman feels pretty good. You look at Green Arrow, and if you're just a normal publisher that doesn't seem to have any weird overarching goals or anything, you look at that and you say, geez, this book is on a collision course with us having to make some sort of a decision. Maybe. And of course, like, if you believe in this whole, like, rebirth mantra, then you go, well... I haven't seen any announcements about any cancellations. So what is this book going to look at 3 to 4 months from now? And what is DC going to do about that? Which, yeah, I don't know. It's very odd in that regard. And it's, you have to wonder what they're going to do, especially because at least for me, when I look at DC, there are certain books that never get canceled. Yeah, they might struggle. They might have problems. They might really have problems. Cough. New 52 Green Arrow. But they never get canceled. You just switch things up enough and the book jumps back up, hopefully. And Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino coming on Green Arrow is an excellent example of that. But if you look at Rebirth and you say, let's look at the trends, let's look at what seems to be guiding this movement, like the whole idea of no cancellations, and you look at that and you're like, what are you guys going to do? Especially because a consistency in art teams and a consistency in just teams overall seems to be another one of these mantras, which is, of course, a huge double-edged sword.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting to look at these numbers and think about that. And just, if they have a commitment to not cancel anything, you have to be able to absorb some bad sales. And I mean, across the board, the whole industry is on a downward slump. I mean, it's not just DC. I mean, right. You're seeing the whole industry. And I think that a focus on good, consistent, creative teams will carry you or weather you through any sort of sales slump.
Yeah.
And I think DC, and this might be deviating a little bit from the rebirth itself, but I think the biggest success of DC since last year, since they launched the rebirth, has been the Young Animal series, where
yes.
You have a focus on lesser known or newer characters, you know, younger creative teams, little off the wall book. They're in continuity, but they don't ever cross over really more or less with the main continuity.
Right.
And those are books that I think are geared toward trades. They're geared toward readers that are newer. They're geared toward people that probably don't even like superhero comics. And that to me has been the biggest success.
It's geared towards the people that stand in front of their friends and go, "Oh, superhero comics? I don't read those."
I mean, but those are the books I'm most excited about. As sure. much as I'm liking Batman and
Cave Carson, Batman, is the fucking best thing ever.
That's some of the best stuff coming out right now. So mm-hmm, I mean, right. That might be helping offset some of these big slumps in their more mainstream superhero titles.
Yeah,
and I think Paul just hit the nail on the head, which is if you look at this blueprint of rebirth and you assume that nothing is going to change, then you have to ask the question. I know there are some DC executives looking at the same information, possibly more detailed information, and what's their fucking endgame, really? And right. I think it's borrowing a page from Image, the Image plan of trades will save us. So mm-hmm. The end goal is before we get to trades, we need things to be as accessible as possible getting to that trade point, not changing teams, not rebooting books, keeping our issue numbering consistent. So when we go to trades, people see the same artists, they see consistent numbering, they don't see multiple volumes number ones, they find the book, they grab the right volume, and it's accessible and it's easy.
Yeah.
And I think that when you look at rebirth with trades as an endpoint, it actually starts to kind of click into place. Let's tell quality stories. Let's not get into the bag of tricks with number ones or crossovers or events, and let's just make things angle towards trades. And that even becomes more clear when you look at the fact that DC's new 52 trade model, which I enjoyed because I'm a weird person, was that the hardcover book came out first, and then when hardcover book volume number 2 came out, that's when softcover book number 1 came out. And when hardcover book number 3 came out, that's when softcover book volume 2 came out. And they've actually flipped that around, and now the first volume that comes out is a soft cover, and then after a certain period of time, a hard cover comes out, but that hard cover is going to include soft cover volumes 1 and 2.
Oh.
So it's a much more accessible model that puts lower prices first, more accessible prices first, and allows for smaller collections, which of course also makes things a little bit more easier on the wallet. So when I look at that, in addition to everything else, like, it feels like we're borrowing from Image's playbook, which, of course, is not a dumb thing to do at all.
Right.
Yeah, I think like, across the board in the industry, I think it's trades and graphic novel sales that are actually saving the industry. Well, the numbers that we're looking at here, we spoke about so far, have been single-issue floppy sales, and this mostly only includes physical. I think there's some estimation on digital, but no one really has any hard data on digital.
This doesn't include anything but North America. Yeah. It doesn't include digital. It doesn't include books that go to second, third, fourth reissues.
Yes. Right. So what's interesting to say is that, like, sure, maybe the industry looks like it's on a downward slope for single issues. I think that's just going to be the continuing trend for a long time. Yeah. Until we get any information about digital, we won't really know how that's doing, because you don't know, like, maybe, you know, Green Arrow is selling really well in digital singles because people just don't want the physical books anymore. We don't know. But I think that regardless, there is a trend that you can see from Comic-Con, you can hear across many different websites, that there is an uptick in graphic novels and collected edition sales because people just don't want to spend either as much money over a long period of time And it's much easier to just store, right? And I think digital sales are the same way, right? Like my best guess would be that digital trade sales are probably crazy high because usually you're getting a serious discount. Like especially if you look at the prices on Amazon compared to an actual physical paperback, usually looking at $10 across the board. Marvel and DC maybe have a little bit of an exception, but a lot of the times the digital collected editions of books are way cheaper. And so until we can, you know, somehow get that data from whatever, I don't know if Amazon or Comixology is going to release that data ever, we can't really know how that's doing. But I think on the whole, there is an understood trend that collected editions are selling better than they were, say, 10 years ago. And that's why you see so many more available options of collected editions, specifically at shows. If you go to comic conventions, I've been to New York City Comic Con twice now. And Image's booth, they don't even sell any singles. There's no singles on the table at all. It is all collected editions. Same goes for Dark Horse. They don't sell any... Well, actually, that's not true. They usually have a small bookshelf of singles, but then everything else is graphic novels and collected editions of books and special editions of books, which people go apeshit over. So I think that we're seeing an uptick in those types of sales, if only because people want whole stories at, you know, from the get-go. You can be that person that reads the single issues every month, but the majority of fans out there, especially new readers and people that are finally ready to get into comics and stuff like that, they want a collected edition, which is why you'll see a lot more books survive past the, you know, 4 or 5 issue mark, Marvel withstanding, to see how the trade sales do. Because if the trade sales kick butt, then that single issue story is going to keep going every month waiting for the next volume. Right. I think you can point at any Image book and you can see that to be completely true.
Right.
And I think what's genius about double shipping, especially when you want to talk about the concept of trades, is that double shipping, of course, increases, you know, quite literally, you know, or at least in theory, it doubles the speed at which you have more trades coming out. And of course, with people that are, they don't really have their finger on the pulse of things, and I guess by that I mean they aren't buying single issues. The idea that you've got more trades coming out frequently puts these books in trade buyers' minds, you know, so much more readily and so much more frequently. You're not just sort of waiting around a year for the next book, maybe half a year. Now you're waiting maybe a quarter of a year or just half a year for the next volume, and so these books, you know, manage to keep themselves in people's minds a lot easier. And I think that works too. So then I guess DC's big question is, are we, if the trades are going to make up the difference, are we concerning ourselves with just flat out telling good stories? And I think in that regard, they're doing a great job.
Yeah. I think that could be the biggest success. I mean, numbers and sales aside, I think across the board, everything I've ever heard about, especially about books I don't read, is that people are pretty enthused about these books still a year in. So that says a lot to their commitment to injecting new blood into the creative teams. You know, having someone like Geoff Johns step aside, really, from the editorial aspect of the DC line. He's doing more stuff with movies and TV now. Obviously, he's going to be doing whatever the big Watchmen reveal will be down the road.
Doomsday Clock or whatever they're calling it,
yeah. Having him step aside and having someone like Tom King step into the Batman, which is... I have to assume their biggest selling book. I mean, Batman is the most popular character that they have. So, I mean, I think that speaks to their commitment, like you said, to telling good stories, regardless of, you know, the numbers.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys have much more, but, you know, I think we can wrap up. I think we've said all that needs to be said. Maybe we'll do another status update in a year or something, but let's round out the show. I hate this new credits thing, even though I was the person that decided we should do it. I mean, really. So you can follow the show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. Nick, you can follow on Twitter at Death Star Plans. It's spelled really weird, and he spelled it last week, so go listen to
Death
that.
Death like Megadeth, star like it should be in plans, like there's no vowels. So
and a Z.
And a Z.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that too. Jeez.
Yeah, Nick, you got the weirdest handle. He's a private account, so you'll be one of the chosen few if he lets you follow him.
That's right. And I picked the name before Rogue One, so you know. Way ahead of the curve on that.
So Paul, you are on Twitter as Oh Hi Pauly. What else is up with you?
Oh Hi Pauly. You can find me there on Twitter and Instagram if you want to see my mug. on your phone, pictures I take. You can also find my other podcasts that I do, Spike Pile Driver. It's about professional wrestling. Me and my buddy Mean Matt, we do it twice a month. Find that on all your various podcast platforms and on Twitter at SpikePilePod.
Yeah, you guys have the coolest art for a podcast ever, by the way. I just want to put that out there. You really should be. You really should be.
It's so good.
You can follow me on Twitter at Mike Rappin. You can also follow the show at IRCB Podcast. I started today writing Medium articles about X-Men questions, so you can also find me on Medium at Mike Rappin. It's a whole thing. I don't know. I don't know where this whole thing with questions is going. My buddy Renee threw like 10 or so questions at me, and I plan to answer them all in very long, semi-detailed, totally biased articles.
Yeah, he's like, I've got questions. You're like, oh, that's interesting. And then he posts like a picture of a moleskin notebook with a, yeah. It looked like something out of like Memento or the sort of Reddit thread where someone's like, I found this in my basement, guys. I need help. What's mm-hmm. going on?
So I'm documenting that.
On top of that, you can follow us on our Goodreads group. Just go ahead and Google Goodreads, I read comic books. It's probably the number one search result. Heck, I think you can Google I read comic books, and I think the Goodreads page is the number one search result then as well. So you'll get there. It's not a concern of that. You can go there and you can follow certain comment threads on show episodes. You can talk about comic books and movies, comic books and TV. You can also join the discussion for our monthly book or book of the month, I guess. And you can also contribute to the voting on that book of the month. There's a lot to do. There's a lot of civil discussion. People are writing in full sentences and putting out highly articulated points. So as you might guess, I'm not on there that frequently. Self-dig. We have a website, ircbpodcast.com. It's great. I highly recommend it.
If you go to the website, you can, of course, find the links to the episodes and our weekly pull list that we post every Tuesday.
Yes.
Books we're reading that we didn't talk about in the show. If you enjoy the show or if you have some constructive criticism for the show, please rate, review, and subscribe. That helps us out a lot. Lets us know what you guys think about the show, and it helps promote the show so we show up on the Google searches more regularly. Mm-hmm. If you have some specific questions, if you have questions about the X-Men or Gambit that you want Mike to answer, email us.
Yes.
ircb@destroythesybe.org. That's a great way to get in touch with us, ask us questions, feedback, comments. We love to interact with the fans, so thanks for doing that.
Thank you, Paul. Infinity Shred does all the music for our show. They're the absolute best band in the entire universe. We cannot be more thankful to have their music as part of our show. Xander is an audio editing wizard. He's also a real life wizard. I think that he ascends to the high mountains once a year in order to recharge. So that's his whole thing. And finally, to round off the show, I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who listens and comments and talks with us and does all this stuff, contributes to the Goodreads, like makes this show worth doing every single week. We appreciate every piece of information and every person out there who listens and downloads the show. So thank you. Thank you so much. And until next time, we'll check you later. Thank you again for listening. Nick, I just need a button that turns your fucking brain off, Nick. Jesus Christ. I was like, please, just quickly go through this thing. Oh my god. Oh,
I just liked, hey, we have a website, but there's no reason to go there, so why even bother? Thanks, Nick.
Oh man. All right. That's about it. Thanks for listening, folks. I'm just going to put a random number in here. Hope Xander figures it out.